U.S. Congress formally certified Joe Biden's electoral college votes, clearing the way for him to become president on January 20th. The Iranian president says that the chaos unleashed on the U.S. Capitol by supporters of President Trump shows how fragile and vulnerable Western democracy is. Protests over the killing of 11 Shia miners by Daesh Takfiri militants in Pakistan's Balochistan spread to other areas, including the economic hub, Karachi. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. U.S. Congress has certified electoral college votes in the 2020 president election, paving the way for Joe Biden to take an oath as the 46th president of the United States.
The whole number of electors appointed to vote for president of the United States is 538. Within that whole number, a majority is 270. The votes for president of the United States are as follows. Joseph R. Biden, Jr., of the state of Delaware, has received 306 votes. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 232 votes.
The House of Representatives and the Senate in a joint session approved the results, putting an end to months of dispute and election fraud lawsuits by incumbent president. And that after both chambers rejected two objections from Trump's allies to overturn Biden's victory in Arizona and Pennsylvania. Following the Congress decision, Trump said that he totally disagreed with the outcome of the election, but there would be an orderly transition of power on the 20th of January. On Wednesday, Congress went into recess when Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building in a bid to push lawmakers to overturn the election results. U.S. police say at least four people were killed after supporters of the outgoing president stormed the Capitol Hill to prevent the certification of electoral college votes for the president-elect. According to the D.C. police, one woman succumbed to injuries after being shot by law enforcers. Three other protesters died in medical emergencies. At least 52 people have been arrested, D.C. police saying that they have recovered two pipe bombs at the headquarters of Republican and Democratic national committees. The unprecedented violence prompted Washington's mayor to extend the public emergency to 15 days. That's until Biden's inauguration. Coinciding with riots on the Capitol building, pro-Trump rallies were held at state houses in several cities, including Los Angeles.
Back up! Back up! Back up!
Riot police made a number of arrests after the gathering outside L.A. City Hall turned violent. Sporadic clashes also broke out between Trump supporters and Black Lives Matter protesters. A similar event in the city of Salem, Massachusetts, turned violent. In the capital of Oregon, pro-Trump ralliers burned an effigy of the state's Democratic governor. At least one person was arrested. In Kansas, protesters entered a state house in Topeka and assembled on the first floor. Several government buildings in Denver and Atlanta were ordered closed due to protests near their state houses. Rallies were also held in a number of other state capitals, among them Little Rock, Tallahassee, and Santa Fe. A writer and journalist, John White, says the supporters of the outgoing president consider him an anti-establishment figure and a protector of their rights.
It's no surprise that Trump doesn't accept the result because he operates in a post-truth universe and always has, as do his followers. And my friend in Beijing is quite right that he is seen as the anti-establishment candidate after years of neoliberalism had created so much damage, created so much inequality and poverty, and caused so much havoc in people's lives. But they voted for him not on the basis of class, but on the basis of race. And when he said, "America, make America great again," the one word missing from that sentence, but which everybody knew he meant, was "make white America great again." He has played to the fears of white working class people, especially in the Deep South and the Midwest, over a rising tide of black assertion, black pride, And the irony is that the Black Lives Matter protest movement and these protesters who've stormed the Capitol building have much more in common than they have to divide them on the basis of class, on the basis of their economic condition. Race has always been the way that the elites in the US have been able to rule over working class people on the basis of ethnic, cultural, racial differences.
Political commentator Einar Tangen believes that a post-election chaos in the U.S. brings to surface the decline of the middle class and a crisis of confidence that threatens the future of the country.
I think that you really have to delve into why it is that so many people in America are supporting somebody who's so obviously flawed. I mean, why would evangelicals support somebody like Trump, given his record and his morality, or lack thereof? I think the U.S. is at a crossroads. I do think it does have something to do with the declining population of white voters. But there's also a lot of concern about the decline of the middle class. People feel that they have been cheated. They blame the elites in Washington. Trump represented something different in their minds. They have become emotionally wedded to him. But unfortunately, he's a populist charlatan who has led them down the wrong path and has endangered the United States.
Well, that's not only it. Reactions are still pouring in following the Wednesday violent riots by President Trump's supporters in Capitol Hill. Amnesty International has slammed Trump's rejection of election results, saying that his incitement of supporters has fanned the flames of chaos and violence. Amnesty says that the U.S. president's refusal to facilitate a peaceful transfer of power has put human rights, public safety, and the rule of law at grave risk. The violence also drew criticism from Germany.
The scenes at the U.S. Capitol we have seen are the result of lies and more lies, and dividing and a contempt for democracy, of hatred and hate speech, also from the very top. That is a historical turning point for the United States. And it is an attack on the liberal democracy. But I am convinced the U.S. democracy is stronger than this hatred. The democratic institutions are stronger than the hatred.
Steinmeier says that hatred and agitation, lies and violence all threaten democracy. The Russian Foreign Ministry has also reacted to the recent tensions in the U.S. It says that the archaic U.S. electoral system that does not meet democratic standards and the politicization of media were to blame for American division and unrest in Washington. Moscow says the violence is largely the result of the social gap in the United States. Here in Iran, President Rouhani says that the storming of the Capitol Hill shows the weakness and failure of Western democracy.
What we witnessed in the United States yesterday evening and today shows above all how fragile and vulnerable Western democracy is. Its foundations are not solid. We saw that populism has taken roots in these Western countries despite the advances in science and industry.
Rouhani called outgoing U.S. president populist, who's ruined his country's reputation over the past 4 years. He said an unqualified person in power is so harmful not only to his nation but the world as a whole. Rouhani expressed hope that the world would get rid of all unwise leaders, urging the next U.S. administration to follow the path of law and rationality. Now, the Iranian foreign minister has warned that President Donald Trump is a security concern for the entire international community. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that what's disturbing is that Trump has unchecked authority to start a nuclear war. Zarif said that a, quote, rogue president who sought vengeance against his own people has been doing much worse to the Iranian people and others in the past 4 years. The Iranian top diplomat was apparently referring to the deadly clashes that broke out on the U.S. Capitol grounds on Wednesday. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says that the country is capable of enriching uranium with a purity of up to 90%.
The progress made means that we can easily enrich uranium up to 40, 60, or even 90%. Of course, the text of the Parliament's Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions law stipulates that the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran is required to enrich uranium above 20% if need be. We have the capacity and the capability to do that today.
News Galavandi was referring to a recently enacted law which is aimed at forcing the signatories to the nuclear deal or the JCPOA into compliance with the accord. The law requires the government to reduce its commitments unless the nation's interests enshrined in the JCPOA are safeguarded. Now, in line with the legislation, Iran has stepped up uranium enrichment on Monday from less than 4% to 20% purity. Tehran says that the measures are reversible if the other parties to the nuclear deal meet their share of commitments. In 2018, U.S. President Trump unilaterally withdrew his country from the JCPOA, throwing the deal into chaos. The Syrian president says that the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani has made the Syrians determined to pursue his path in the fight against terrorism. Bashar al-Assad has stressed that Soleimani will continue to live in the hearts of the Syrian people. He highlighted the Iranian commander's efforts in defending Syria against terrorists and enemies, and that in a televised message on the occasion of Soleimani's martyrdom anniversary. Addressing that event, Assad's advisor, Huthaina Shaban, has stressed that the murder of Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander al-Muhandis created a new alliance in the region. He said the two commanders exposed Zionist plots in the region. Also, Iran's ambassador to Syria, Javad Zarqabadi, condemned Soleimani's assassination as a violation of international law.
The criminal act of assassinating General Soleimani was a violation of international law and was condemned by the international community. The move will bring ultimate defeat for the United States in the region.
The Iranian envoy said that General Soleimani will be remembered in history as a fighter for justice. Zarqabadi stressed the fight against terrorism will continue until the total victory of the Syrian people against aggressors. General Soleimani and Muhandis were assassinated last January near Baghdad Airport in a U.S. drone strike ordered by President Trump. Correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, tells us more about General Soleimani's anniversary, the ceremonies in Syria, and how important his presence was in the region with regards to fighting terrorism.
General Soleimani's role was very important for the people of this region, for Syrians, for Iraqis, for Palestinians, for Lebanese, because what General Soleimani used to do was he used to help all of those forces in order to get rid of terrorism that killed the people of this region. And this is why everyone in this region respects and appreciates General Soleimani. For example, in Syria, General Soleimani for years helped in fighting terrorists of Daesh, whether we're speaking about Deir ez-Zor, eastern Syria, Bu Kamal, Aleppo, southern countryside, even areas around Damascus. He did not just fight terrorism, he also fought a plot by the United States and its Western regional allies to destabilize the entire region. And this is why he is very important for everyone here.
An Iraqi court has issued an arrest warrant against President Trump for ordering the assassination of senior Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis. The court says it's still investigating to find the other culprits in the crime, be they Iraqis or foreigners. Under the country's law, death penalty is applied to all cases of premeditated murder. Muhandis was assassinated along with top Iranian General Soleimani and nine other people in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad last January. The UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Executions, Agnes Kellermert, described the killings as arbitrary and illegal. Iran has also filed a red notice with Interpol that requests the arrest of Trump and 47 other U.S. officials. Protests over the killing of 11 Shiite miners in Pakistan's Balochistan province have spread to other cities in that country, including the economic powerhouse of Karachi. Sit-ins were held in at least 19 locations in the southern metropolis. Protesters slammed the massacre as a systematic ethnic cleansing of the Hazaras in Balochistan. The demonstrators set block the road in the provincial capital, Quetta, with the coffins of the slain workers. They refuse to bury the victims until their demands are met, which include the resignation of the provincial government. On Sunday, Daesh terrorists brutally killed miners in a residential compound near a coal mine. Hundreds of Hazara Shiites have been killed over the last decade in militant attacks in Pakistan. Saudi Arabia has fallen into a budget deficit of $79 billion U.S. dollars through a combination of the crash in oil prices and the impact of COVID-19. But is there more to its economic woes than meets the eye? We have more on the Saudi budget deficit in our upcoming episode of Economic Debate.
Saudi Arabia has long prided itself on its abundance of natural petrochemical resources, with oil being the main source of income for the Saudi kingdom that sits on top of some 266 billion barrels of oil. Yet the financial crash of 2020, sparked by a combination of the Saudi-Russia oil price war, as well as a slump in demand due to the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, has left the Saudi regime with a huge budget deficit. However, it seems that it's not just a drop of income that has hurt the Saudi coffers, but also the reckless spending by the Saudi regime on military hardware that appears to have taken its toll, as corruption, high commission on deals, and overspending has been reported by a former advisor to the Saudi Ministry of Finance and current professor of economics at George Washington University, Hossein Askari. With Saudi spending on US weapons still playing into the 11th hour of Trump's presidency, it now remains to be seen as to whether the incoming Joe Biden will emulate his predecessor in sales, or whether, in fact, the Saudi regime can even continue to afford to spend lavish amounts on arms at the risk of their checks bouncing.
Venezuela has appointed a new head for parliament. Jorge Rodriguez is the man who is now leading the country's Congress, promising to give his all-out support to President Nicolas Maduro's administration. From Caracas, we have a report.
Following the landslide victory of Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party in last December's legislative election, former Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez has now been appointed as the new Speaker of the nation's Congress, also known as National Assembly. Rodriguez, who is widely regarded as one of President Nicolas Maduro's closest allies, has claimed that the newly elected Congress will work exhaustively to promote the policies of the country's president. The assumption of Rodriguez as head of parliament puts an end to a five-year-long control of the congressional body by the opposition, through which the spat between the executive and the legislative produced political turmoil in the Latin American Republic. Socialist lawmakers praised the designation of Rodriguez, although in the opposition some complain about the new head of parliament. Nonetheless, experts believe that the new parliament is a politically balanced body now. Now that Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has regained control of the country's Congress, many believe that President Maduro is more stable than ever in his office, while the opposition has hit bottom in political terms. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
When detainees at an Alabama jail got sick or simply asked to be tested, they were put in solitary confinement, says Clarissa Donnelly D. Robin, writer, in an article published under the heading, Immigrants Detained by ICE Say They Were Punished for Requesting COVID-19 Tests. Here is the details of this article. ETOA, which contracts with the federal government to hold people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, stated in court documents that it was taking precautions recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including quarantining new arrivals, implementing social distancing measures, and providing cleaning supplies. But Golding and more than a dozen other ICE detainees say the measures taken were inadequate and led to a massive COVID-19 outbreak. Seven of the men say they were given only one disposable mask every 3 weeks. One shared a photo of what he said were the only cleaning supplies he'd received: a toothbrush, toothpaste, comb, and combination shampoo body wash, which came inside a gift bag from the Salvation Army emblazoned with the words Merry Christmas. Immigrants inside ETOA also said that many new arrivals were quarantined for 5 or 8 days rather than the recommended 2-week period, potentially allowing the virus to spread. According to a partial ETOA roster obtained by The Intercept, and in these times, ICE transferred at least 24 people into the facility in June. By the second half of July, the agency reported that 21 detainees, nearly a quarter of those housed in ETOWA's ICE unit, were sick. When Golding came out of his cell and saw the condition of those around him, the organizer part of his brain clicked back. I'm looking at people that's literally looking play in the face, he said. And medical is doing nothing for them. Golding decided to tell everyone in the unit to request a test for COVID-19. So you have Africans, you have Jamaicans, you have El Salvadorans, you have different groups, Golding explained. What I did was say, hey, listen, you talk to your people, you tell them this. Many people were apprehensive about asking for a test, as guards had already put the few who were presumed positive into solitary confinement, a fate the United Nations says amounts to torture. In solitary, detainees said they were locked in cells without air conditioning for around 23 hours a day. The average high temperature in July in Gadsden is 91 degrees. Nevertheless, by July 4th, everyone in the unit, more than 80 people, had put in requests to be tested, according to interviews with Golding and another detainee, as well as the affidavits of 9 detainees included in a petition for a writ of habeas Golding filed on his own behalf in the Northern District of Alabama in September. 2 days later, according to the 11 detainees, ETOWA County Sheriff's Officer Captain Mike O'Brien called the lockdown of the unit and read out the names of 10 detainees who'd been especially vocal in calling for mass testing, including Golding. O'Brien told them to pack their bags because they were being sent to solitary confinement. At the time of their transfer, none had tested positive for COVID-19. All 11 sources said they felt this was punishment and retaliation for requesting the coronavirus test. I noticed that all of us who were randomly picked were the ones who were vocal, outspoken, and shown desire to be tested, Stanley Walden wrote in a complaint dated on August 7th. He handpicked cells and made an example in front of everyone that he really meant to throw anyone who get tested into a dungeon. Sebastian Abalo Cano wrote in a complaint dated on July 28. "It feels like punishment for standing up for our right to health and safety," he said. After locking down the unit, the captain and other staff members went cell to cell asking the remaining detainees if they still wanted to be tested for COVID-19, according to Golding and the affidavits of nine others. Most detainees revoked their request and agreed to sign waivers saying they no longer wanted to be tested. In a recorded conversation involving two Itaewon employees obtained by The Intercept and in These Times, one employee described the events of the July 6th as an attempt to bully people into not getting tested. Afterwards, both employees said in the recording, "Immigrants inside Itaewon appear too scared to seek even basic medical care." Four of those who were sent to solitary confinement said they were unable to communicate with their families for days, leading some concerned family members to call the facility. The relatives of one detainee said jail staff assured them that their family member was fine at the time he was in solitary confinement, having developed symptoms of COVID-19. Golding's mother said she was told there was no evidence of the virus at the facility, even as ICE listed at least one coronavirus case at Itaewon on its website. According to the family members interviewed for this story, neither ICE nor Itaewon ever reached out to tell them their loved ones were sick. The Itaewon County Sheriff's Office did not respond to detailed questions from The Intercept and in These Times about the jail's COVID-19 precautions, the detainees' allegations of retaliation, and whether detainees had authorized the release of their medical information to family members. "The health, safety, and welfare of those in our care remain a top priority and concern for the agency," a spokesperson for ICE wrote in an emailed statement. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, ICE has taken extensive steps to safeguard all detainees, staff, and contractors, including reducing the number of detainees in custody by placing individuals on alternatives to detention programs, suspending social visitation, incorporating social distancing practices with staggered meals and recreation times, and through the use of cohorting and medical isolation. ICE's public guidance on how detention centers should respond to the pandemic says facilities must ensure that medical isolation is operationally distinct from administrative or disciplinary segregation or any punitive form of housing. Yet, as a previous investigation by The Intercept found, a number of ICE facilities have failed to adhere to this requirement. According to detainees at Itaewon, solitary confinement was used not only as leverage to discourage requests for testing, but also to isolate people with COVID-19. The Intercept and in These Times spoke with five men who tested positive for COVID-19 while detained at Itaewon. Each said he spent weeks in solitary confinement. Chamoy Edwards developed COVID-19 symptoms just days before Golding. At first, he planned to quietly sweat out the illness, but with a history of bronchitis and a recent diagnosis of a sickle cell trait, he got too scared to ride it out on his own. He hobbled over to an officer and told him he felt like he'd been hit by a truck. Not long afterwards, Edward said he was transferred to solitary confinement. The men universally described the conditions in solitary confinement as squalid. In their affidavits, many expressed distress that they no longer had access to mental health professionals, the law library, sunlight, or fresh air. "Civil detention have turned into torture," Philae Koroma said. Bakhtir Majidov, who was deported in September, wrote that there were cockroaches and flies in the unit. Golding wrote that he was fed uncooked frozen food and didn't have access to drinking water because the sink in his cell didn't flow properly. One detainee said he spent 21 days in isolation. Another counted 35 days and a third counted 54. Golding said he was in solitary confinement from July 6 until August 28. Edouard said he was put in isolation on June 29th and wasn't released until July 28. "We were getting the same treatments as when you get in trouble," Edouard said in an interview. "Even though it's properly a different word, it's isolation. It's still a form of punishment, a form of torture that they are putting us in." Edouard received the results from his coronavirus test on July 8. He was positive. One day later, Golding received the same bad news. In isolation, the men say their phone access was limited. They could only make calls during a brief daily free period, no more than 75 minutes, which occurred on an irregular schedule. Sometimes they said it might be in the middle of the night. Before he got sick, Edwards would speak with his mother and brother a few times each week. After not hearing from him during the 5 week of July, his brother, Nico Edwards, who is a police officer in Flint, Michigan, called Etowah. The first person he spoke to transferred him to someone else. "That person answered and told me that they looked in the computer and they told me Shemoy is okay. He's on the floor and nothing is wrong with him." Nikoi believed the facility at first. Then a few weeks later, his brother finally called, telling Nikoi he was in solitary confinement and had the coronavirus. The U.S. criminal justice system and the immigration system are deeply entangled, with harsh consequences for black immigrants in particular. One out of every five people facing deportation because of a criminal conviction is black. As of July, about half of the people detained by ICA at Etowah were black, including Golding, Edwards, and many of the other men interviewed for this story. Several are lawful permanent residents who lost their green cards and became deportable after criminal convictions. Rather than accept deportation, many immigrants remain at Etowah for years as they fight their cases, often because they have nothing to go back to. Golding and Edwards were both born in Jamaica and came to the United States of America as children. Edwards, now 30, arrived at 15 on a green card. Most of his family now lives in the United States. Golding, now 36, arrived at age 9 to reunite with his mother, who had fled an abusive relationship. He has never been back to Jamaica. Before being incarcerated by ICE, Golding served a 10-year sentence in federal prison. He and his family say they didn't know there would be immigration consequences for his criminal conviction and that he was served his time. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Those Who Feel the Fire Burning. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. He is also a program advisor for the BFI London Film Festival. And Nassim Ahmed, who is a political analyst and writer for Middle East Monitor. Now, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, directed and written by Morgan Kanibe, is an unconventional, artistic, and powerful documentary about the refugee crisis. The film shows the level of poverty, humiliation, and other afflictions the refugees have to endure as they are stuck in a hopeless situation on the borders of Europe. Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, that was a very emotional documentary. Lee, if I can start with you first. Now, there's been a wave of documentaries about the refugee crisis. What makes this documentary so unique and different?
Well, I think the first question is it even a straight documentary? I mean, definitions are very fluid, but I would term it an essay film, which is a film that kind of blurs the lines between fiction and documentary and is often operating in a kind of very sort of meditative or contemplative tone with a sort of very, you know, focused first-person thing. And what they do in this film with this kind of free-floating, you know, disembodied point of view is...
You're sort of a wandering ghost, aren't you?
You're a ghost, yeah. At the beginning there's a very harrowing shipwreck, and it's as if one of the people who didn't make it from that crossing is now sort of wandering as a sort of spirit around Europe and sort of encountering various, you know, refugees and sort of experiencing a little bit of each of their stories. So in that sense, it's very unconventional, but very striking as a result.
Mm-hmm. And Nassim, if I could go to you next. What was your take on Those Who Feel the Fire Burning?
Well, when I first watched it, I mean, I agree with Lee. I mean, it's very immersive. It really takes you into the life of a refugee and their experiences, but there isn't a grand narrative. Most documentaries, as we know, they have a clear idea as to where they're going, and you get a sense of what the problem is, what the issues are, mm-hmm. and even maybe, you know, recommend some solutions to those problems. That's usually the format of a documentary, but here you're left with lots of questions, background questions as to where they're from, you know, who are these people? I mean, we know they're refugees, but where are they from? What's their story? Why is this person taking drugs? So it immerses you into their experiences, but leaves me lots and lots of questions about their background and stuff like that.
And that's exactly what I would like to actually ask you about while you're here, to give some context to this situation. Now, this documentary was made a few years ago, but the refugee crisis is still ongoing. So would you say that this documentary will stay relevant for years to come?
I think the experiences of these refugees will be relevant for a long, long time, because these are shared experiences. These are people who have left their homes, and this is a shared experience throughout the world. Anyone who leaves their homes to a different land, they will face this kind of subjugations, and they will be living on the margins of society. That's how most refugees live. So from an emotional perspective, from this visceral connection which you have with refugees, I think that would stay with you as a form of art for many, many years to come. But in terms of providing context and information about the real issues about facing refugees in Europe, I don't think it really touches on those issues much. Like, for example, 5 million refugees coming from Syria, and how that's affecting the socio-political climate within Europe, how that's changing the demography within Europe, and the insecurities it's creating, the political turmoil it's led to. So those kind of questions is not even addressed by the documentary. But in terms of, as I said, as a program which touches on the feelings and the emotions of refugees, I think it will stay with us for a long, long time.
Lee, would you have liked to have seen that, some more political context, and some sort of the questions raised while watching this documentary?
It's a tricky one, because on one hand, I really admire the sort of artistry and you know, trying to frame a film about this subject in an entirely different way. It's much more like a sort of Terrence Malick film, you know, with the sort of free-flowing narration. You don't even know who's talking sometimes, or it's not necessarily connected to... Most traditional feature or documentary films about refugees, you follow a small number of protagonists. And like you say, there's a clear, we're here, we need to get to here, and this is the goal. And so they follow a very sort of traditional narrative thing. Michael Winterbottom's In This World, or Diego Quijada Diaz is The Golden Dream. You know who these people are, and so it's the film's counting on you to empathize with and then put yourself in the place of those characters. Because this film is doing this much more sort of free-floating, sort of collage type thing, it maybe loses that direct connection. It's trying to put you in the point of view of someone you don't ever see.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that sort of, you know, empathy that we traditionally get in films, of that's our character. How would I react in that situation? It's not trying to do that. So it loses the sort of specifics that Nazima, and you know, where are we? How long have they been there? All of these facts and sort of details are, you know, deliberately omitted, but it's much more after a sort of experiential type thing. And, you know, there are pros and cons to that approach. I find it very interesting as a film, but if I was studying, you know, if I was trying to understand the refugee crisis in Europe from this film, I'd be left, as Nazim said, with a lot more questions than I had at the beginning.
Well, some really great, interesting points that you made, but I have to say, I really love the transitions between places you see, and it's quite beautiful. And Lee, we see a refugee child there. What kind of conditions do you see them exposed to in this documentary?
Oh, it's horrific. I mean, it's, you know, and, you know, what it's showing there is what we've seen so many times also in the news, you know, horrendous scenes of children. Because those are, you know, as much as your heart goes out to anybody in those situations, when it's children who obviously have no concept of the wider, you know, implications and ramifications of what's going on, it's horrific. I mean, from what I've read, the UNHCR website talks about like over 65 million displaced people, over 22 million refugees like that right now, and over 50% of those are under 18. So you see the sort of the scale of the tragedy that's affecting everybody, but a very big preponderance of young people, including kids. And it's horrible. I mean, I have a daughter myself. The idea that your young family could be in anything like the situation that we see some of these individuals in is just, it's almost unimaginable. But yet, it's happening right now, you know, countries not very far away from us.
And I think you're right in saying that, and children are bearing the brunt of this crisis. And listen, can you shed more light on this? I mean, what other conditions are they exposed to, and what other hardships do they have to endure?
Well, we get a perspective from the doctor I met, who was actually going in and out of the refugee camps in Greece. And he was saying, I mean, some basic things like dental health, for example, it's leading to a situation where you have young children who have no access to dental health. So he goes and provides, an NGO which he belongs to goes and provides provisions for dental health, and say 65% of those, we think it's a minor issue, you know, but all of us know what it feels like when your teeth is aching, and it's one of the worst pains you can imagine. Mm. And he's saying young children, you know, facing massive dental problems within these refugee camps. But that's just one example of many of the basic health issues which are lacking in those refugee
camps.
There's
also the issue of child exploitation, sex trafficking.
That goes without saying. You know, we've had reports after reports which the UN publishes and also EU publishes of child exploitation. And the other day we had a report which showed that refugees on the boats, they were actually forced to jump off, and 50 led to 50 actually dying. So the smugglers, as they were being caught, you know, they forced the refugees to come off the boats. So you hear horrific stories like that, and we see that every single day. But in terms of the real situation on the ground, I think many of them have said that they would rather have not made the trip to Europe and have seen that they're actually stuck in refugee camps with no chance of having any kind of asylum or entry into the country. So
it's interesting that you say that. And Nazim, I want to pick up on a point you made just before we went to the clip, about how the refugees thought that going to Europe would be the hardest part, but in fact it's the easiest part. Do you think people would be surprised to know this?
I think even our personal experiences, people I've met as well, they say that once they're here, they expect certain level of, you know, certain conditions, certain living standards, and those expectations are not met. And many of them have been stranded, as I said, in camps, some living on streets, hoping that their, you know, lives will improve. But that's the dreams have not really materialized. It's not really dreams, it's basic expectations which they came to Europe for. So we see that, you know, on the streets as well, refugees trying to make a living cleaning windows. You know, these are people who are struggling. You know, they're not being processed properly by the system. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how many of them will actually get any kind of asylum here in the UK. Many in the Scandinavian countries, as Czech Republic, for example, they're actually paying some of the refugees because of their own personal political situations, the far right, you know, getting more and more support. They are actually paying refugees to leave their countries because of their own political situation. As I said, the far right thriving in support. So refugees themselves, they said, you know, it's much, much harder now, and they would prefer to have actually not made the journey. We hear that from refugees in Syria. Not to mean that they're all facing this kind of situation. Most refugees would still prefer to live here in Europe trying for asylum because situations in Syria, in Afghanistan, those war-torn countries which have been bombarded for the last decade or so, they'd rather be in this situation where they at least have an opportunity to find some kind of a better living condition than face the bombs and the barrel bombs in Syria or in Afghanistan or other parts of the world as well.
Ali, I want to bring you in on here. So we see after that perilous journey a refugee makes, you think there'll be some relief at the end. What was your reaction to this scene?
I mean, I think the entire sort of thesis, if you like, of the film is that these people are in purgatory. So you get this disembodied ghost. And I mean, the trailer that you showed at the beginning is like, you know, is this heaven? Is this paradise? And it's like, well, if it's not hell, which it could well be, and you see some of the horrendous situations they're living in, it's certainly this limbo. So they are stuck. They're not, you know, they're not citizens now of any country. They're not being looked after where they are. They can't go back to where they came from. And for me, one of the most nerve-wracking scenes I've seen in any film recently was just after the clip that we showed there, where there's this, the men trying to climb up the huge chains that have moored into the ship to try and get up. And you see this guy going up, and because it's not, you know, Tom Cruise outside an airplane, you know he's safe. But I had no idea if this man was going to make it. And he's very high up. He's really struggling to reach the ship. And it's absolutely nerve-wracking to watch. And you just realize the desperation that you must be, A, to have left your country in the first place, and then still to be trying these very, very sort of risky ways to still, you know, get further away from where you see the danger. So it's really that what it brought it home to me is the desperation and also just the limbo that these people find themselves in. It's heartbreaking.
I think that's a really perfect analogy to describe it as a sense of purgatory, and that the struggle's not over. They're neither here nor there. Lee, you were just talking about purgatory, but death is a very harsh reality that the refugees face almost on a constant basis. What did you feel watching this scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because my understanding is that entire sequence is from a short film that Morgan Knibbe made before Those Who Feel the Fire Burning called Shipwreck, and he's literally just put the whole thing in there. And I think there's even clips from a student film he made in Greece. So he's obviously dedicated a huge amount of his time and energy to putting to this issue. And so to put it all together like this, you know, I don't find the film exploitative, but there's one shot, we didn't show it in that clip, but it's from that same sequence where you just see all these Western journalists and people holding up their cameras and looking into it. And I really got a sense of like, that's kind of us in a way, because, you know, the average citizen of a European country, we see these images, it's so easy to get inured to them and sort of almost numb to what the reality of, you know, the individual stories. And yet we're constantly fed them.
Mm. But we're desensitized.
Yeah, it's this weird sort of, not parasitic per se, but it's this weird relationship where we're constantly, you know, people are desperate to get that next shot. You know, some of the horrendous images we've seen of the young boy who drowned at sea or the young boy sitting in the back of the ambulance covered in sort of soot. I mean, they stay with us, but at the same time, it's like, well, is it actually doing anything to make us change our attitude or, you know, more importantly, the governments of these countries to change their attitude? And that's a really debatable question. I mean, I think the very fact that, you know, a young Dutch filmmaker has spent that amount of time trying to address this issue in a different way is a positive thing. But at the end of the day, you know, it's the change is going to come from, you know, legislation and governments, you know, changing their ideas. And that's, as always, is the big sticking point.
And Nassim, I want to throw that question at you, actually. Does that resonate with you? I mean, what responsibility do journalists, people in the media have when it comes to covering the refugee crisis?
I mean, that very scene, the first question that came to my mind was, it seems there's a sense of voyeuristic, you know, the cameras, the lenses pointing at the woman crying. Her suffering, for me, in a sense, if you sit within the broader European context, it just seemed there was a disconnect there, because Europe here, the cameraman and the journalist are using this to actually feed a wider anti-refugee, anti-Islamophobic rhetoric that's taking place in Europe at the moment. So for me, they were not using the word exploitation, but I think it was in a sense being exploitative, not the director per se, but the other journalists, because they were using this to show that we are somehow being taken over by these immigrants, these refugees, and we know refugee has shifted politics, not just here in the UK with the Brexit and with Brexit, and also in Europe as well, the rise of the far right, and this is all on the back of the refugee crisis. So those shots, those clips which we really empathize with, those clips which really give us a sense of what it really feels like to be a refugee and the hardships they face, but they are being exploited to actually show a different narrative to the average person here on the streets in Europe, so that, you know, we are being overrun by refugees, our country is being changed, our culture is being taken over.
Is so Europe dealing with the crisis very well?
But from a narrative point of view, I don't think it is, because it's showing that somehow, you know, the non-Europeans, Muslims in particular, they're taking over the country, which is statistically, it's just completely wrong. It makes no sense whatsoever. 5% of Europeans are Muslims, which is, if you live for another century, the demography will not change much. But I think the rise of the far right is something that's very real, and it's taking place here, not just in Europe, in America, but it's around the world. You know, you see the rise of the far right, and they're exploiting the refugees as the main, you know, main bandwagon. It's something which they're using to actually push this narrative that we are taken over by Muslims, and which really isn't true. And this kind of movie, hopefully, maybe it might stem the tide of people's emotions and senses as to where, you know, what the real problem is. The problem isn't Muslims coming over. The problem is there's wars in Europe, which Europeans have actually helped in supporting. Like Britain is still paying money to the Saudis, and also
it's really interesting that provoked that kind of reaction watching this documentary for you. But I suppose the documentary doesn't address that point so much. But final 20 seconds to you, Lee. What message does this documentary leave you feeling?
Well, I mean, ultimately, even though it's doing it in an unconventional way, it is still very much trying to connect you, the viewer, and probably a Western viewer, to the plight of people from other places who are going through incredible suffering. The fact he's doing it in a more overtly artistic and sort of aestheticized way, then it's debatable whether we get to grips with the facts, but as a sort of a piece of filmmaking, you know, I think it's very valid to try that different approach, but it comes with its pros and its cons.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining the Doc Review sofa. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.